Chapter 6. Evolution and its implications. A quick recap before we move on. In the great order of priorities, God comes first, with his original creative work and his later redemptive work in Jesus Christ. The next big thing, from your personal perspective, is that you have come to know him. Then, and only then, there's the Bible. It is God's inspired record of his courtship of erring humanity, and as such is of immense value to us Christians. In third place it may be, but it's very important. We've concluded that it was never intended to be the how-to manual of church practice, doctrine, or life skills that some have tried to make it. That it isn't a contract we can use to browbeat God into doing things for us. And that it isn't a science or history textbook, but a document reflecting the worldviews and lifestyles of its ancient compilers. Knowing all this frees us from the kind of bondage to the Bible that has produced untold division and often made Christian people unattractive to outsiders. We have cast doubts on the inerrancy claims made by some hardliners. We've even expressed some misgivings about the Bible's infallibility, but we have satisfied ourselves that, in spite of all this, it is indeed God's Word, in that it is sufficient to bring us into relationship with him through Jesus, who is the Bible's focus. Now we look at how, in the light of all this, we should view the opening chapters of Genesis. Are they scientifically accurate? We do this because of the present widespread block-poking on this sensitive subject. We looked earlier at the Bible's geocentric view of the solar system. We concluded that, in light of what scientific discovery has revealed, we can accept today's heliocentric view without feeling that by doing so we have to ditch the entire Bible. Today's big issue in Christian circles, of course, is not whether the sun goes round the earth or vice versa, it's evolution. Some Christians get as steamed up about this as their 16th century ancestors did about the other. And the time will come, I suspect, when evolution is as universally accepted by Christians as the views of Copernicus. My advice would be to save yourself a lot of hassle by facing up to it here and now, but I'll understand if you need to feel your way gently in that direction. If you're looking for a deep scientific treatise here, you'll be disappointed. Like most people, I'm not a scientist and so have to rely first on what scientists discover, and secondly, on the assessment of it by people who combine sincere Christian faith with enough grasp of science to be able to distinguish the wheat from the chaff, plus the ability to express it in language simple enough for you and me to understand. Happily, there are a fair few of them, and from what I've read of their works, I comfortably accept that, in the wake of God's creative act, macroevolution is indeed responsible for the multiplication of species, including the human race as we now know it. The way God is and acts, I believe, cause it to be that way. If we allow this, even as a possibility, we have to accept that we can't take the early chapters of Genesis literally. Many fine Christians down the centuries have reached that conclusion anyway, including, as far back as the 3rd and 4th centuries AD, the likes of Origen, Tertullian, Athanasius, and Gregory of Nyssa. The great Augustine of Hippo wrote at length on the subject early in the 5th century AD in a piece called The Literal Meaning of Genesis. He concluded that it's unwise to read that book as a factual account. So, if you share that view, you're in good company. Not that Augustine and the others believed in evolution, of course. That didn't become an issue until after Charles Darwin published his On the Origin of Species in 1859. But they had the insight to realise that Genesis was providing something other than a literal blow-by-blow account of the original creation. So let's consider what it might be instead. And we'll extend our inquiries to the Pentateuch at large, to look at its authorship and its intention. For a long time, it was believed that the Pentateuch was written personally by Moses sometime in the second millennium BC. While most scholars now question that, there remains a strong likelihood that he compiled much of its material, possibly during the 40 years when the Israelites were in the desert travelling between Egypt and Canaan. But the opening of Deuteronomy suggests that much of the Pentateuch is about Moses and what he said, not necessarily by him. Indeed, the first verse indicates that it was written by somebody who had crossed the Jordan into the Promised Land and was thus writing about Moses in the past tense, since Moses died before the Israelites entered the land. There are references to his death in Deuteronomy chapter 34, where the phraseology points to the books having been written long after him. Scholars, both Jewish and Christian, including Jerome as long ago as the 5th century AD, surmised that the Pentateuch was put together around Ezra's time, that is, after Judah's return from exile in Babylon, getting on 1,000 years after Moses. Yes, Moses no doubt contributed substantial parts of the writings that were later compiled to form the Pentateuch, but whether he was the primary author remains open to question, and it doesn't really matter. Similar timing clues appear elsewhere in the Pentateuch, including in Genesis. In Genesis 12 verse 6, for instance, which refers to Abram's travels in Canaan, we read, "At that time the Canaanites were in the land." This suggests that they weren't there when the author wrote those words, which must have been after the Canaanites had been largely subjugated or destroyed. That means after David's time, centuries after Moses. Certainly, it seems ridiculous to imagine that Moses himself wrote, "Now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth." That's Numbers chapter 12, verse 3. If he wrote that, he wasn't very humble at all. Factors like these have led Christian scholars to a sensible conclusion. The Pentateuch is a collection of ancient documents by several authors, including Moses, compiled from various sources into its current form over a long period, and brought to a conclusion by editors who worked after the return from exile. Those editors were guided, it seems, by their desire to give the Israelites a sense of their long-term relationship with God as his special people, and so to ground them firmly in their national history. That view makes a lot of sense. I personally have no problem accepting it as the Pentateuch's likely source without needing to jettison my conviction that it remains part of God's revelation. The Jews of Jesus' day, as far as we can see, probably believed that Moses had written all 5 books personally. Their tradition had taught them that, and they had no reason to question it. Jesus was a Jew of his time, and so presumably took the same view. He quotes the Pentateuch with phrases like, "Moses said." It's quite likely, however, that "Moses said" had just become a shorthand phrase for "the Pentateuch says," due to its close connection with him. Either way, don't let this be an issue for you. In his incarnational humanity, Jesus experienced the limitations that all humanity experiences. He got hungry and tired, for instance, and he lived with the Jewish worldview of his period, including its angle on the Pentateuch. The fact that he was at the same time the Son of God is irrelevant to this issue. In being made in human likeness, he became a man of his times, and that need cause you no problems. Your salvation is not in doubt. God had his hand on the whole thing. Now let's return to the purpose for which the Pentateuch in general, and Genesis in particular, was written. That will then bring us back to the creation account and the evolution issue. We sometimes forget what a disaster the exile of Judah to Babylon was for its victims. The Jerusalem temple, the focus of their worship and the localized dwelling place of God, had been razed to the ground. The city itself lay in ruins, with its key citizens dragged off to Babylon. The promises of God, it seemed, had failed. There was no descendant of David on the throne. Indeed, there was no throne for anyone to sit on. God had deserted them and had let them be routed by Gentile invaders. Where did that leave them? Did they still have a meaningful identity as the people of God and a future with him? The problem didn't go away when a remnant of Jews returned from exile after 70 years. True, they rebuilt the temple, albeit a smaller version, and got the Levitical worship going again. But they remained under Gentile domination even in their own land, and the future looked bleak. In that sense, their exile was still not really over. Would things ever improve? Were they in fact still God's people? Scholars are of the broad opinion that it was largely to answer such questions that what we call the Old Testament was brought together under divine direction, partly from existing sources and partly by the creation of new documents. Its purpose was to remind the Jews of their glorious past and thus provide a foundation for them to build on. It assured them that, in spite of the appalling setbacks they had suffered, they were still the people of God. As one scholar summarizes it, "The creation of the Hebrew Bible is an exercise in national self-definition in response to the Babylonian exile." The people of Israel were saying, "This is who we are. This is the God we worship. We are indeed his people still, and on this basis we can move forward." We must look at Genesis in this light. Earlier, we noted the way ancient peoples commonly compiled accounts to explain their origins. Genesis, and particularly its creation stories, are Israel's version of such an account. We should look at Genesis from that perspective, the scholars insist, and not from a modern scientific one. To confuse the two approaches would be as inappropriate as confusing a Shakespeare sonnet with a textbook of advanced mathematics. They are two different genres. One key feature of all such ancient accounts, we noted earlier the Babylonian one called Enuma Elish, is that they describe how order was formed out of chaos. On that basis, the creation account in Genesis chapter 1 should be seen not as describing creation ex nihilo, that is, from nothing, but as the way God brought order out of the chaos that already existed. Sure, you can believe that God did create originally from nothing, but that's not what Genesis is describing. We're not here looking at scientific data. We are looking at Israel's convictions about their God, what he is like, and what he has achieved. What he is like is very different from the gods portrayed in similar ancient origin stories. Israel's God is all-powerful, bringing order out of the primordial chaos simply because he chose to do so. He did not consult any other gods because he was without equal. Some of the other ancient stories show the sun, moon, and stars as themselves gods. But for Israel's gods, they are objects no more, which he put in place as he wished. These factors alone set Israel's origin story apart from those of other nations that we know about. It presents a distinct and altogether superior God. Then comes Genesis 2. Which presents a different creation account from chapter 1. The differences are major ones. Some Christians have struggled hard to reconcile the two accounts, which is necessary only if you view them as factual, scientific accounts, which they are not. Certainly, whoever was responsible for compiling the early chapters of Genesis was comfortable to let the two accounts sit side by side without feeling any need to make them more amenable to each other. That's a bit like the two verses in Proverbs on answering a fool. Both are true, but with different emphases and applicability. It's a wisdom thing. Just as the first account shares features and style with Enuma Elish, The second one has parallels with an ancient Mesopotamian document called the Atrahasis Epic. This, like Genesis, has much to say about the first humans, the growth of the population, and a great flood. Here we'll focus on the Adam connection. Both accounts describe the creation from dust of humans, who were then given the breath of life. Both have woman being made from the man's rib or side. Both have a plant that confers immortality. Both have nakedness covered, and more besides. Nobody knows whether one of these stories influenced the other, and it doesn't really matter. What does matter is that both reflect an ancient way of looking at origins that is pre-scientific, and it's thus inappropriate to try to give factual scientific status to either account. The Genesis account stands as part of God's revelation and tells us much about the human condition that is relevant today, but it is a theological statement, not a scientific one. You might need to pause and let that sink in. And don't worry that your fundamentalist Christian friends might call you a heretic if you admit to such views. Just tell them that to be a follower of Jesus does not mean being anti-science, and that you're on a journey of discovery on which you're having to reconsider some of your long-held opinions, and continue to be kind to them, even if they're not kind to you. If the opening chapters of Genesis, then, are not a scientific description of the original creation, what are they describing? Scholars know from studying the literature of ancient peoples that they were more interested in function than material origins, what things were for, and how they fitted into the bigger picture. Scholars also know that the Hebrew word bara, translated created in Genesis 1 verse 1 and 10 times more in that book, plus instances in the rest of the Old Testament, is more to do with establishing function than with material origins. That, it seems, is what is going on here. Creation need not always be about material origins. Today, a college principal might create a curriculum, or a managing director create a committee. Both manipulate existing people, places, materials, and time slots in order to fulfill a specific function. That's what Genesis is about. Genesis 1 and 2 are not an account of an original creation. When God began his work, as described in Genesis 1, everything was chaotic, unproductive, and non-functional. That was about to change. Cosmic creation in the ancient world, says one specialist, was not viewed primarily as a process by which matter was brought into being, but as a process by which functions, roles, order, jurisdiction, organization, and stability were established. So, on day one, God established time, defined by alternating periods of light and darkness. On day two, he sorted out cosmic space to create the functions that make possible what we call weather. In particular, controls on rain, without which human life is impossible. And on day three, he sorted out terrestrial space, separating land from sea to provide a place where food can be grown. The remaining 3 days are where God, having established the appropriate environment, put what we might call functionaries in place there. He started on day four with the sun, moon, and stars, to which he assigned time-governing functions. On day five, he established the role of sea creatures and birds to be fruitful and multiply, and by so doing, to fill their respective realms. Day six extended this mandate to land creatures. But people were assigned an additional function. Since God had made them uniquely in his own image, they were to govern the rest of the natural world on his behalf. God commanded, and it was done. In these 6 steps, the original chaos became a fully functioning working system. Genesis 2 offers a different account, where the focus is on Adam and Eve. Today, as we noted, many Bible scholars see these as archetypal figures representing human beings everywhere. The dust from which Adam is made is a pointer to universal human mortality. Eve's formation from Adam's rib or side is not meant as an anatomical description, but as an archetypal one, pointing to the way men and women tend to relate. That the text is not talking about two specific individuals here is suggested by the fact that after the early chapters of Genesis, Adam and Eve don't figure again in the whole of the Old Testament, except briefly in the opening genealogy in 1 Chronicles. They reappear in the New Testament, of course, but there too they are treated in archetypal ways. Now, here's an important point. The opening creation story in Genesis has 7 days, not just 6. On day 7, God rested. And in the context of the functional view that Bible scholars have proposed, this is the climax, the most important day of them all. What is it all about? Here, the scholars assure us, we are into temple terminology. That's the only way an ancient reader would have understood it. God has sorted out the chaos and put working systems in place, so now he can rest in the sense of enjoying a stable state of affairs. With the job done, he can go home, so to speak, and run things from there. And since he is God, home means a temple, which by definition is the dwelling place of a god and also the control centre from which he runs things. Where or what then is the temple God lives in? All ancient Near Eastern people viewed their stone-built temples as symbols of the cosmos, and the Israelites were such a people. So the creative work of God described in the opening chapters of Genesis is, in fact, the construction of a cosmic temple for him. And it only becomes that temple in the full sense when he takes up residence there. That is what he does on day 7. Viewed this way, the creation accounts in Genesis are not about material origins at all, whether of the universe in general or of humanity in particular. They are theological stories that tell us what God is like, how he brought order out of chaos, got the cosmic temple into sound running order, then moved in as God and governor over it all. Arguments about the age of the earth are completely out of place in this context. So are speculations about the multiplication of species and the origins of the human race. Genesis is simply not addressing such issues, not even remotely. I believe this myself, and I do so without my respect for Scripture being in the slightest way affected. On the contrary, I feel thrilled that the great God presented there condescended to reach out to ancient peoples within the limitations of their pre-scientific worldview and make himself known to them. It's wonderful. Accepting this view leaves us free to look at the available scientific evidence for the age of the earth and the origins of humanity without being pressured to choose between that evidence and the words of Genesis. And that evidence points to an old earth and to evolutionary factors in the multiplication of species, including the origins of humankind. We Christians should not run away from scientific evidence. Instead, on the basis that all truth is God's truth, we should embrace it with enthusiasm. And all the evidence is that the earth is very old indeed, over 4 billion years. Quite frankly, the efforts of some to prove that it's only about 10,000 years old are laughable. Their so-called creation science is not taken seriously by the scientific fraternity at large, with good reason. And we should not be taken in by the claim, too often bandied around in Christian circles, that a good proportion of serious scientists support young earth creationism and reject evolution. That is simply not true. This is not the place to list the evidence for an old earth. I will instead point you at the end of the book to some works by Christian authors who are themselves scientists and are totally convinced by the data. The same goes for evolution and human origins, but I'll make a comment or two on that here before we move on. First, I'm personally satisfied that in God's purpose, Homo sapiens evolved through early humanoids from even earlier life forms. I feel no pressure at all to harmonize that with what Genesis says about Adam and Eve, for the reasons given above. At what point the image of God became part of humanity, we have no idea, and probably never will, so I don't lose any sleep over that. Second, we're talking evolution here, not evolutionism. It's a vital distinction. Some oversimplify evolution, then elevate it to the level of a philosophy, propounding a life view where everything is grim, ruthless, and down to the survival of the fittest. On that view, life today has no room for virtues like altruism, caring, and self-sacrifice. Might is right. We reject that philosophy. Even the basics of evolutionary science are not that simple, for scientists have shown that the process is vastly more complicated than many would have us believe, and that there is clear evidence for positive, altruistic elements in the process. Most of you will be familiar with David Attenborough, who, over many decades, has presented some wonderful TV programs about the natural world. He's a man totally captured by the wonder and immensity of it all, and his enthusiasm is infectious. He believes in evolution, of course, and this upsets some Christians, one of whom said to me, "I love the David Attenborough programs, but I always watch them with the sound off." What a shame! I watch them with the sound on, and with delight, astonished at once by the beauty and complexity of God's vast creation, and by the evolutionary processes he used to bring it to its present state. Do I have to choose between evolution or creation? Absolutely not, and neither do you. Get real about all this. Rejoice in God, His Word, His world, His endless creativity, His vastness, His love, and His reaching to us in Jesus. As Paul put it in a different context, all things are yours. Science and its findings are yours. I've learnt that there's no point in wasting mental and emotional energy trying to answer unanswerable questions. If humans evolved from earlier life forms, at what point did they become responsible before God? Where did the devil come from? How did sin first manage to infect everything? And why did God allow it? What should be our view of death? Was it part of God's original plan or not? You won't find definitive answers to questions like that, either in the Bible or anywhere else. The important thing is to face up to current facts. Evil is clearly real, and sin an ever-present problem. Humans today are responsible before God. Death is all around us. But we don't despair about such things because, through Christ, we've come to know that these and similar issues will all, in due course, be resolved. God, who is love, will bring His purposes to happy fruition in the fullness of His kingdom. So let's focus on that and determine not to get ourselves into a knot over debatable topics that we can neither grasp nor change. Face these issues full on, then. To be a Christian, you don't have to believe in a flat earth, or a young earth, or an earth that has the sun going round it. In this turbulent sea of challenge, your faith can keep bobbing to the surface like a cork, no matter how big the waves, because the life of God inside you will keep you afloat.